This is the place, and this is the time. Here and now, the mystery awaits to break into our experience, to change our minds, to change our lives, to change our ways, to help us see the world and the whole of life in a new light. This is the place. This is the time. Here and now, let us praise the mystery by joining together in song. At the center of our service and at the center of our lives, we take this time to light candles of memory, candles of hope, or because we feel troubled, blessed, conflicted, or simply because we'd like to add a little light to the world. Would you join me now in an attitude of prayer? Mystery of many names and mystery beyond all naming. We come to you this morning with many things on our minds. All of us here have had a week in which we have been presented with problems that need solving. Help us to remember that life is not a sitcom that can be digested and solved in 26 minutes. Help us, Great Spirit, to realize that sometimes our life's work is but the beginning, middle, or end of a problem or solution that's been going on for thousands of years. In this vein, give us the strength, that is, help us to know that we have within us the strength to do whatever it is that needs to be done, regardless of the immediate outcome, and remind each and every one of us that there are wild cards in life, things that we could never have guessed in a million years that can, do, and will affect the outcome. Let our thinking be such that our minds are not closed around what we see to be the solution. Let our vision can encompass ideas, thoughts, and solutions that may at first seem foreign and not to our liking. Finally, give us all the strength to face the impossible as simply an idea that keeps some of us from trying. For everything that we do, every idea, every lesson, every child of ours, and even ourselves, we all face death on a daily basis. Let this not be a source of futility, but rather a source of the greatest joy, as we realize that what we do in spite of this. Perhaps in the very face of death, we find a meaning that transcends both life and death themselves. We pray this in the name of everything that is holy, and that is precisely everything. Amen. I have two readings this morning. One is a traditional Buddhist scripture, and the other comes from a book called God's Dog, Conversations with Coyote by a Unitarian minister in Santa Fe, New Mexico, by the name of Reverend Webster Kitchell. First, the Buddhist scripture. What is born will die. What has been gathered will be dispersed. What has been accumulated will be exhausted. What has been built up will collapse. And what has been high will be brought low. And then from Reverend Kitchell's book, "Nothing personal," said Coyote, "but I really don't like your kind. I think First Woman made a mistake when she created you as a species. You humans are coming to be a real curse on the planet. Nothing personal. Some of you I like individually. I find you entertaining in a coyote sort of way. But by and large, you live in a weird world in your heads. You live in a complicated set of lies, both personal and social, which you believe, even when they obviously don't work. I think you humans are a real threat to us all." I wish I could say that this sermon was going to be uplifting. It's a tragedy with no heroes or heroines. It's a farce with the government wielding sledgehammers instead of rubber ones. It's a love story of a people who will not be dominated by those who have the money. It's a whodunit with the surprise ending that we've all been at the scene of the crime, and we've earned ourselves a spectator's badge without even knowing it. It's an essay on how democracy was hijacked by guys wearing Dockers who are married to soccer moms. It's a lament that sings of loss and more loss. It's a prairie coyote howling at the moon, sending its prayers for food and water to the great creator. And finally, it's the blues, can't get none, ain't none in sight, and it looks like a whole bunch of none is in the future. I've been to the borderlands 4 times in the past few years, and every time I go, I wonder why I went. Why do I seem willing to witness what I witnessed there? What is it about these hopeless and God-forsaken people that draw me to them, that find in them a source of both strength and harmony? How could I have imagined that a contract worker working for $75 a week with his wife, 2 daughters, and a son would speak like a president, and the man so elected would conduct himself as if he were the one deprived of good sense, deprived of the simple ability to speak the king's English, deprived of his compassion. Yet this is the borderlands, and it is its story. All presidents since President Polk, all presidents of the United States since then, have acted thusly toward the borderlands, and she's really tired of it. So I come to witness and see with my own eyes the very thing that scares me the most, poverty. The very word evokes a desert land of just about everything that has to do with nothing. There's another caveat in this sermon. If you've got a good financial portfolio, there's a pretty substantial chance that you're complicitous in the poverty that's going on to make up the borderlands. But don't worry too much. In a greater or lesser sense, we're all complicitous. Ralph Waldo Emerson made the comment before the Civil War that those who had financial interests in the South and could not speak out against slavery had altered the Unitarian belief in the perfectibility of man. Emerson said that these invested Unitarians were less interested in the perfectibility of man and more interested in the perfectibility of their pocketbooks. There is a sense in which this paradigm still exists today. To understand the borderlands, to understand anything that's going on in Mexico, we must take a look at the past. So here we go. I'm going to give you the Mexican Revolution in 5 minutes. The first question we have to ask ourselves is, why would a country that had an honest-to-goodness proletarian revolution at the beginning of the 20th century have labor problems at the beginning of the 21st century? These people had an honest-to-goodness, workers of the world unite sort of thing, so how could they have failed to secure the rights of the workers? The Mexican Revolution started in 1910 when a dictator by the name of Porfirio Diaz was divested of his power. The revolution lasted 7 years and culminated in the signing of a new Mexican constitution in 1917. Their proletarian revolution happened before the Ruskis. Mexico had 2 popular revolutionary leaders, Pancho Villa in the north and Emilio Zapata in the south. When Diaz was forced to hold elections, the man who had led strikes against his dictatorship, Francisco Madero, was elected president. But neither Zapata in the south nor Villa in the north supported Madero. Zapata and his farmer armies weren't willing to wait for land reform, and there was essentially a civil war between opposing rebel forces and 1 million Mexicans, that is, 10% of the Mexican population at that time, were killed in that revolution. Zapata declared himself president in 1911. His armies chased landowners off their property in the south under the guise of coming to the aid of a U.S. soldier. The United States Army invaded Veracruz in 1914 and stayed there for 7 months. Villa kept crossing the U.S.-Mexican border, and finally in 1916, General Pershing was sent to Mexico after him. A 70-year-old Ambrose Bierce disappeared into this part of the revolution and was never heard from again, but was later lionized by Gregory Peck in the movie Old Gringo. Madero, the president who had no one supporting him, was assassinated in a coup led by General Huerta. The majority of revolutionaries revolted against the government set up by General Huerta, and the governor of the state of Coahuila, Venustiano Carranza, formed a constitutional army and instituted the majority of the rebels' social demands in a new constitution that was ratified in 1917. Then, one by one, the revolutionary leaders were done away with. Carranza had Zapata ambushed, but then Carranza, when he was running for election as president against General Obregón, well, General Obregón felt sure he would be defeated in that election, so he had Carranza killed to make sure that didn't happen. General Obregón turned out to be a terrific organizer, and he founded the Partido Nacionalista Mexicano, the PNM, which then ruled for 70 years until Vicente Fox was elected president in the 1990s. As one researcher put it, the revolution did eventually lead to social and political change of significance, but one could argue that very little of the ultimate outcome was envisioned or planned for by any of the revolutionary factions. Ultimately, what made the Mexican Revolution revolutionary was the way change was channelized by popular struggles. The final outcome was, one could argue in many respects, a continuation of the project of pre-revolutionary regime of Porfirio Diaz, that is, a project to develop and modernize the country through the action of a centralized state. In other words, the more things changed, the more they stayed the same. To quote another researcher, post-revolutionary class structure was relatively unchanged in spite of the widespread mobilization and revolution. Historically, then, we're up to date. During the 70 years that the PNM ruled the country, the maquiladora system started up. Basically, maquiladoras are assembly plants. Jobs that used to be done in the U.S. and other countries get outsourced to Mexico. Why? All you have to do is go home and Google the word maquiladora, M-A-Q-U-I-L-A-D-O-R-A, and guess what comes up? The first thing on your screen, you can save 75% on your labor cost if you just move your company's workforce south of the border. The first maquiladora that appeared was in 1965. There is no coincidence that this is, in fact, the height of the labor movement in the United States. The chief reason why things have gotten worse south of the border is the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. This one lands right in the lap of the Democrats and President Clinton. You've all seen the bumper sticker that says Clinton lied and no one died, but you'll never see the bumper sticker, Clinton agreed and the wage slaves were not freed. On Friday, 2 weeks ago, I traveled with the American Friends Service Committee to Mexico. It's an organization sponsored by the Quakers. Four times a year, delegates from the AFSC travel to the borderlands. These delegations are made up of anybody who wants to go. Events are planned for the trip, but the main event is the firsthand witnessing of what's taking place on the border. We went to the town of Piedras Negras, and it's actually a very clean border town, and the reason is Piedras Negras means black rocks. It was industrialized early because there was coal there. I was impressed by the lack of trash and the quaint square in the middle of town and the pink stucco Catholic church right off the square. On the first evening, Friday night, we had dinner at the home of Juan Hernandez. I've changed all the names in this story because there have been reprisals against labor organizers in Mexico when sermons and other speeches are publicized. Juan, his wife, two daughters, and a son live in a concrete block building that's maybe 400 square feet. I believe his brother lives there also. Juan's wife fixed us gorditas for dinner. They were incredible, and we ate outside in the cooling twilight. After dinner, Juan told us that in 1999, before NAFTA, he made between $140 and $160, not pesos, dollars a week. Now he makes, doing exactly the same job, $40 to $60 a week. The management of the maquiladoras used to give workers 6 months to a year contracts. Now they extend them 20 to 30-day contracts. What impressed me most about Juan was his ability to articulate his problems. He said that what disturbed him the most is what we are leaving for our children and our grandchildren. We are leaving a horrible legacy of bad environment and evil labor practices. Juan works for the CFO, the Comité Fronterizo de Obras, and for anyone who speaks Spanish, lo siento. The CFO is a union that is independent from the Mexican state. During the revolution and the industrialization of Mexico, it was decided that unions would be state-run. Unfortunately, this means that unions are not on the side of the workers, but on the side of the manufacturers and managers. The main purpose of the CFO, the union that is organized by and for the workers, is to help the workers understand the Bible of Mexican labor. That's a book about this thick, and it's red, and it has all the Mexican labor laws that have been enacted. Mexico actually has good labor laws, but the workers are barely informed of their rights, so good labor laws without informed workers are meaningless. The next day, we traveled to 84 kilometers from Piedras Negras to Ciudad Acuña, and there we met with Teresa Isabella Rodriguez, a CFO organizer. She helps organize workers in the neighborhoods by helping them understand their rights under Mexican labor laws. In the afternoon, we had lunch at the offices of the CFO and met with workers from various maquiladoras. What we learned there was astonishing, and you may not believe it. The managers of the maquiladoras are in charge of all the monies that are paid workers. So, if there is a worker who has worked at a maquiladora for many years, there's a substantial amount of money that that person is owed when the plant moves, if it moves. The managers have taken it upon themselves to see that those workers are not paid their proper monies. One worker we met with is locked in a room 2 by 3 feet every day with water and let out twice a day to go to the bathroom. He's being paid, but he's not being allowed to work. The hope is that he will become disgusted with this treatment and quit. If a worker quits his or her job, they are not entitled to their severance monies. Another gentleman who worked for Delphi, a subsidiary of General Motors, he's worked for 7 years, was put back in the beginning class where he was originally taught how to sew seat covers. There he was told to sew and unsew the same seat cover all day long. He is able to work, but his work is meaningless, and the hope is again that he will quit in disgust. A gentleman known only as Don Giovanni said that these tactics are worthy of the descendants of Hitler. Citing examples of how Holocaust prisoners were made to carry rocks from one pile to another, then they carry the same rocks back to the original pile, this man condemned such behavior as fascistic and torturous. I'm thinking now of Maria Reina Sanchez. I met her on a trip to the borderlands in February of 2005. For 3 years, 6 days a week, for 45 hours a week, she dipped her unprotected naked hand into toluene. Why? To simply wipe the fingerprints off the instrument panels of General Motors cars. On her face, she wore a paper mask, the kind you might wear if you mow your grass and you have allergies. Toluene is a hydrocarbon of the aromatic series, obtained chiefly from coke oven vapors and the distillation of coke tar, and it's highly carcinogenic. Not surprisingly, Maria Sanchez got cancer from the prolonged exposure to the toluene. She was undergoing radiation and chemotherapy when Delphi, a subsidiary of GM, fired her for missing work. They fired her without paying her her severance pay. She got a lawyer, she sued, she won, and she won a whopping $10,000, enough to support her family for 2 years. But she's still dying, and as far as I know, she could be dead. The vision I have of Maria Sanchez wiping fingerprints off GM instrument panels is like the scene of a crime to me. Criminals want their fingerprints removed so that they may avoid prosecution for their crimes. In like manner, General Motors, General Electric, Johnson Control, Kohler, Emerson Electronic, Erica, Tenneco, Maytag, Panasonic, Black & Decker, Goodrich Auto Body Centers, and other foreign and U.S. companies want their fingerprints removed from what's happening to the workers just south of our borders. In the movie The Barbarian Invasion, it's a Canadian-French movie, the main character, a patient in a hospital, is speaking to a nun who works in the hospital, and this is what he says. Contrary to belief, the 20th century wasn't that bloody. It's agreed that wars caused 100 million deaths and 16 million deaths for the Russian gulags. The Chinese camps, we'll never really know. let's say 20 million. So 130 to 135 million dead. Not all that impressive. In the 16th century, the Spanish and Portuguese managed, without gas chambers and bombs, to slaughter 150 million Indians in Latin America with axes. That's a lot of work, sister. Even if they had church support, it was an achievement. So much so that the Dutch, English, French, and later Americans followed their lead and butchered another 50 million. 200 million dead in all. The greatest massacre in history took place right here in the Americas and not the tiniest Holocaust museum. I have a theory why there's no Holocaust museum in the Americas for 200 million dead indigents. We aren't through yet. The slaughter continues, but this time in a more civilized manner. We're letting the greedy corporations of the world do our killing for us, unless, of course, time is of the essence. Time is money, you know. If time is of the essence, then we send the troops in to first clear the way, kill the way, so that corporations can follow. I told you some of the ways that corporations can kill. They pass off their workload to the capos. You remember the capos, the capos, those inmates within the Nazi concentration camps who were Jews but turned against their own kind so that they might live. True. The Mexican managers of the maquiladoras may not be literally killing their own kind, but they are torturing them with meaningless work and playing power and mind games with people whose only concern is putting food on the table. And for those of you who are not willing to buy the argument that corporations are bad, here's what Gerrymander in his book, In the Absence of the Sacred, has to say. Now that we see the inherent direction of corporate activity, we must abandon the idea that corporations can reform themselves or that a new generation of executive managers can be re-educated. We must also abandon the assumption that the form of the structure is neutral. To ask corporate executives to behave in a morally defensible manner is absurd. Corporations and the people within them are not subject to moral behavior. They are following a system of logic that leads inexorably toward dominant behaviors. To ask corporations to behave otherwise is like asking an army to adopt pacifism. There are two lights at the end of this tunnel. The first light is a wild card known as the peak oil theory, put forth by people like M. K. Hubbard and M. Heinberg. This theory states that oil production can be described in a bell curve. There's the period when the well is first dug and tapped and the production soars. Then there's the upward movement of the bell curve. Then the production evens off and we have the top or peak of the bell. According to the peak oil theory, when gasoline and diesel goes over $5 a gallon, it will be too expensive to outsource jobs across borders, be it Mexico, South Korea, or China. The money saved in labor costs will more than be made up for in transportation costs. Perhaps at that time, jobs that have been outsourced will come back to this country, perhaps not. But it looks like the days of the unfair practices and the maquiladoras, and perhaps the maquiladoras themselves, are numbered. Yet how many more will be exploited and die in the meantime? The other hope is that there are worker-owned maquiladoras in Mexico. We visited one in Piedras Negras, owned and operated by members of the CFO, the union organized for and by the workers. It is the maquiladora of justice and dignity. This maquiladora assembles cotton material into T-shirts and shopping bags. They started out with two sewing machines that were made for home use and then bought industrial sewing machines. They work in a space that is neither air-conditioned nor heated. There are a total of five workers, all women. If you're feeling hopeless and helpless, then support this worker-owned maquiladora so they can air-condition and heat their workspace. If this church feels like it, I'd be glad to work with the Social Action Committee to coordinate that funding. There's something else we can all do. Stop buying retail. Put your money underground. Barter. You know, wash machines bought at a garage sale or at a resale shop clean your clothes just as well as a brand new one. A hammer bought at a resale store drives a nail just as well. Yes, there is the argument that if we've all stopped buying retail, the economy in Mexico and this country would go south, that the workers who now have poorly paying jobs would have no jobs at all. But all I can say to that is the same argument was made before the Civil War. what would all those slaves do without slavery? In my opinion, that objection begs the argument. Excuse me, it begs the question. It's cruel. It's meaningless. The important thing to do is be informed that such things are happening less than 5 hours from Austin. And after being informed, it's important to act. Investigate companies you do business with. Don't take a corporation's word for anything. They will always tell you the upside and never tell you the downside. They are fictitious persons who act amorally, and in the end, the only things that count are money and growth. Here's a few things you can do. Join a delegation from the American Friends Service Committee. Go to the borderlands. Become a witness for humanity. Write your Texas senators and congressional representatives. Talk to Donna Howard. Suggest that there are better ways to treat people and that saving money at Walmart shouldn't include wage slavery on any side of the border. In closing, I'd like to remind you of that wonderfully terrible analogy of the world being one large table. At one end of the table are the starving children of the world, hundreds of thousands of them dying daily. In front of them, there is no food. At the other end of the table is where we sit with all the food and our obese children and our culture of television and escapism. Who among us could sit at such a table and eat with impunity? I dare say not a one.